dare you wake me up from my nap in the middle of the Christian day to come do this one thing and then probably go back to bed.
Listen, we're shame going through you. It, y'all.
I mean, shame on you. Welcome to Unfortunately Required Reading.
I feel like March 2020, we started that we're going through it, and then it's just been perpetual ever since.
Good Lord. Peek behind the curtain. Both your hosts are going through it. And my ring light hasn't figured out that I'm African American yet.
Yeah, it keeps trying to make you like super white. And I'm like, that's not the skin tone, friend.
That is not my skin tone. I usually don't notice it, but like today I was like, my ring light doesn't know what skin color I am. Welcome to Unfortunate Card Reading. Welcome to March. Both your hosts are going through it.
Wait, is this our form of March Madness?
Which is literal insanity?
I'll see myself out.
No, that was a good one. Both your hosts are going through it, but we are here to talk about a book that I think both of us like?
Okay. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Ray Bradbury. The book we're reading is Fahrenheit 451, or as I've entitled this episode, Just Real Life in Late Stage Capitalism.
I think I did that one.
Oh, you did that. Okay. Never mind. I did that. I don't know why I put things in there anymore. So, okay, Amanda, that's yours. That's yours.
No, and it wasn't even like, oh, she's taking credit for me. It's like, oh, no, I did something. I contributed.
Okay, I'm going to be honest. I'm so used to putting things in the creative title and then forgetting I did it. Mm-hmm. And then later being like, did I write that or did Amanda?
Zero judgment. Like, that was by no means like, I got you, bitch.
I mean, it would be fair if you did.
No, not at all. Okay, so I'm just coming back from a trip to Waco. I completely forgot how Caucasian Waco is.
And you did inform me that there is no gift shop at the Mount Carmel Center.
There is no gift shop at the site of the Siege of Waco. Out of all the places that I've been to that feels super haunted, that probably felt the most haunted. I didn't take any photos, but my traveling companion Amber did. And we were packing up yesterday. And she's like, the one photo I took didn't turn out right. And I'm like, nope. Nah, that's canceled. Also, I have a bone to pick with history. So, in Waco, during the 1950s, there was a historic tornado. Killed hundreds. And the African-American community at the time thought that the tornado was retribution for atrocities that happened earlier in the history of Waco, like the Waco Horror, which is one of... I mean, there are no, like, chill lynchings, but one of the worst lynchings I've ever seen. That happened in 1916. So, tornado happened, and while we're at the Dr. Pepper Museum, it was like, hey, Dr. Pepper Museum sustained some damage, but out of all of the staff, only one person died. And it was one of the two Black employees. And I just have so many questions about what happened. Why was he outside? Everyone else was inside. What was going on? And of course, you know, the museum's not going to talk about that. It's like, oh, one member of the Dr. Pepper family lost their life. Like, he was one of two Black employees. What happened? Waco was lovely. Fuck Chip and Joanne Gaines, though.
Yeah, I don't get HGTV. I'm gonna be honest. Mm-hmm. My parents are usually watching one of four things. It's either HGTV, mm-hmm. Fox News, which mm-hmm. we already know how I feel about that, cruise videos on YouTube, or mm-hmm. golf. And I know my mom doesn't care about golf, and she doesn't really care about the cruise videos. So there's a lot of HGTV on, especially if I'm there, because we have a tentative truce, which is mm-hmm. don't talk to me about politics, and I won't school you. Mm-hmm. which I still occasionally, when my mom will make a comment, be like, you should read this book. Hey, this is another source you should check out. We are actively not talking about certain things happening in the Middle East right now because I'm like, hey, you want to talk about 100 years of oppression? Let me show you some stuff. That being said, I'm not an anti-Semite. I will not get into an argument with you with Zionists. We're not doing that, okay? Anyway, moving on. This is a really good book, but it will also make you feel like you want to throw up a few times. It's kind of like 1984, where as long this book has been out forever, but you're still kind of like, I see so much of what's happening. I don't really know how to deal with this.
And that might explain why, like, because I've spoiler, I've never formally read this. I went to school in Texas. They obviously aren't going to give away their playbook. they aren't going to give away their inspiration. So, it might explain why so much of this just sort of like washed over me and that like desensitized, like just existential millennial way. Where not that I didn't like it, not that I can't see its importance, but it's just like, oh, this just feels like every day. Like when I stopped having to, like when I was able, so I used to watch V for Vendetta like every Guy Fawkes Day because I'm a nerd. And I think it was around the time that Trump got elected, I had to stop watching that movie because that movie no longer felt dystopian. It felt like looking outside. So let's get into it. Our eating and drinking. I speak English good. Today we are drinking Dealer's Choice because, as mentioned, both hosts are going through it. I, of course, put a packet of Kool-Aid in a Simply Lemonade to make a black cherry lemonade.
That sounds delicious.
I'm stoked.
I have a Baja Blast. I am not having a blast.
I'm not having a very Baja Blast time. I picked up the pineapple one. I'm kind of excited. Pineapple
Ooh.
Mountain Dew.
Ooh, I haven't tried that one.
Want to put booze in it.
Put booze in it. I'm just gonna be your little like devil put booze in it.
Yeah. So if you have any questions on what I'm doing after this, it's I'm ordering chicken nuggets and then I'm putting booze in a pineapple Mountain Dew.
That sounds like a perfect plan. Perfect Saturday.
Lovely. Shall we short story long?
Yes. So Guy Montag is a fireman, which is someone in this world who has the job of finding and burning books. In this American city in the future, they don't really name one, people don't read. They don't go out to enjoy nature or have good conversations or think independently. This is where I'm going to get in trouble. So it's like a MAGA rally. Instead, they have giant TVs that take up entire walls, and you're considered like pretty cool if you have all four walls as a TV, which I know some people who that would be their goal in life. And if they aren't listening to their giant TV, they listen to the radio on what are called seashell radios, which are basically attached to their ears. So as Amanda noted, fascist AirPods.
Yes.
Guy runs into a 17-year-old named Clarice McClellan, and which is really funny when you figure out the little I like the last name is very similar to what his wife's last name was, his real life as in Bradbury. And Clarice is one of those people who is a pretty free spirit. She's kind of like the manic pixie dream girl, where she asks a lot of really innocent questions and is like super into nature and kind of wanders off, and everyone thinks she's a little bit weird, but it makes him start to think about people and nature. And things start to get really weird because and Clarice is like, I don't really like going in fast cars like my friends do. They like to do really dangerous shit. I don't, it's just not for me. I'd rather be out in nature and collecting leaves, and people think I'm weird.
I think she's
So
weird.
I like her. But then again, you got to remember my dad's family, aside from my dad, were mostly hippies. So I grew up with a lot of hippies.
It's like the two kinds of people. Like, I liked her. I thought she was also weird.
So a bunch of bad things happen over the next few days, which feels a little bit like real life. Guy's wife, Mildred, tries to kill herself with a bottle of sleeping pills. He freaks out and he calls the cops and they pump her stuff. Well, they do like a whole blood transfusion thing, which was crazy. But then she just kind of acts like, oh, I did that. Whatever. He responds to an alarm to burn an old woman's stash of hidden books. And the woman instead starts quoting from a trial at Oxford and chooses to be burned along with her books. Guy finds out Clarice was killed by a speeding car. And he's like, wow, life really sucks. I'm really uncomfortable with how things are turning out. And he goes on to a fire and when he's at the fire with a woman, he manages to steal a collection of poetry and hide it under his jacket. And so what he does is he starts looking for answers in books, and he steals them from fires and he hides them in his AC vent and other places. He doesn't show up for work, so his fire chief goes to his house to check on him. Can we have a conversation about how weird it is to have an employer show up at your house when you don't show up to work?
I've seen multiple TikToks about that. And if my employer shows up at my door in like real human meat space, I mean, I'm black in society. I'm not going to do anything physically. But online, I'm going to have many strong words.
Well, this is like the second book we've read where this has been the norm. Like,
yeah.
It's like, I don't know what to tell you guys. If you don't show up 3 days in a row, sometimes they'll call you, at least in my thing, especially if you work from home. They usually won't show up at your house. And if they do, there is something wrong with your employer.
Yeah, they might do a wellness check, like through the police, just because it's like, oh shit, did they die and fuse to their chair? But they don't typically come and visit. Yeah, I didn't like it in the first book we read about it. I don't like it now.
So the fire chief's name is Beatty. He talks to Guy about how it's totally normal to question, what do books have to offer me? Could they be a good thing? And he tells Guy about how books were actually banned because special interest groups kept objecting to books that offended them.
Mm-hmm.
Pause for effect. Just kidding. Books start to look... to all read the same and look the same because no one wanted to offend anyone. Have you guys been reading YA lately? Anyway, society decided it was easier to burn books than to deal with having to offend people. Like, I don't really want to upset anyone. Let's just burn them. What? Beatty tells Montag that he has 24 hours to read whatever he can, and then he has to bring the stolen books in to be burned. Montag starts reading like crazy. He asks his wife to help him, but she's like, what the hell is wrong with you? And watches TV instead.
Mm-hmm.
He remembers once he met this retired English professor in the park, and he's like, hey, maybe this guy can help me understand what the hell I'm reading. The ex-professor's name is Faber. He goes to find Faber, and the professor tells him that the value of the books is in the descriptions of life, and Montag needs to not just read the books, but needs to have the leisure to read them and enough freedom to act based on the ideas that are in the books. Mm-hmm. So just reading them isn't going to do anything. You need to have other aspects.
Right.
Faber's like, bro, I will help you read these. They come up with a super risky plan. Faber will contact a printer and begin reproducing the books. Montag will plant books in the homes of firemen to make them look bad and try to destroy the fireman profession and end censorship.
Gasp.
Faber gives him a two-way radio earpiece so he can hear what Montag hears and talk to him secretly, and it's called a green bullet. So Montag goes home and his wife's friends show up to watch TV. They start talking about an impending war. Like, it's really not important. They're like, oh yeah, there's bombers and stuff. It'll be fine. What's going on right now? This pisses off Montag so much that he takes out a book of poetry and reads Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. Faber overhears all this while listening to the green bullet and tells Montag to shut the fuck up because he's going to get caught. Montag's wife tries to cover this up and says, oh, poetry reading. It's just how firemen demonstrate that poetry is useless. The women leave to file a complaint against Montag, which is not a great idea. Montag goes to the fire station, hands over one of his books to Beatty. Beatty starts to bombard Montag with all these quotes from literature that contradict each other. It's like, look, they contradict each other. They're too complex. It's just not good for you to read. He says they need to burn all the books. An alarm goes off and they rush to answer the call, only to find out it is at Montag's house. And Mildred is bailing out into a cab with her suitcase. He realizes his wife has betrayed him.
Yeah.
He forces Montag to burn down his own fucking house and then arrests him. He berates Montag, who then turns his flamethrower on Beatty and burns him to ashes. He knocks out the other firemen and makes a break for it. And they send out this machine called a mechanical hound, which pounces on him and injects him with an anesthetic. The way that the mechanical hound is described in the books is fucking terrifying.
Yeah, I don't like real dogs. That was nightmarish.
Yeah, reading, I was like, no, thank you. He destroys the mechanical hound with a flamethrower, and then he's trying to walk off with a numbness in his leg. He escapes with books that he had hidden in his backyard. He ends up hiding them at another fireman's house and calls in an alarm from the payphone as a distraction. Mm-hmm. Montag goes to Faber's house. A new hound has been sent after him, and they go after scent. And they have also sent out a TV crew and helicopters, because this is pure entertainment. Faber is leaving to go to St. Louis to find the retired printer. Montag gives Faber money and teaches him how to get rid of Montag's scent so the hound won't come into the house and give the game away. Montag takes some of Faber's old clothes and runs towards the river. The city watches the chase, but Montag manages to sneak into the river and change into Faber's clothing. He heads downstream, follows abandoned railroad tracks, and he finds a group of renegades known as the Book People, which is interesting because there's a store in Austin called the Book People, and now I yes. get it. The group leader, his name is Granger, which is funny. I used to work for a company called Granger. The group is part of a nationwide network of people who love books and have memorized great works of literature and philosophy so they can continue to share the messages. They hope they will be able to help mankind after the end of the war that has just been declared. Montag is told to memorize the Book of Ecclesiastes as part of that. Jets appear and bomb the shit out of the city he fled. Montag and the Book People head out to search for survivors and try to rebuild civilization with the knowledge that they have.
So there's like a weird tone thing in this book, and I'm 100% sure that this is just me. Because there's like the fun subplot of just like, oh, here's a nerd who likes to read a lot, i.e. us. And here's the fall of modern man and censorship, which I mean is also us living in a current society. But like so much of my brain is desperate for escapism that I just keep imagining the Book People as like a fun like group of hobbits.
I would love that if they were a fun group of hobbits. We'd watch Lord of the Rings last night. Fellowship like, of the Ring, we only watched the first one.
Like I keep imagining so much of me just wants this to be like a Fraggle Rock but with books.
Just careful, something. The only thing you have to work out for or watch out for is the poor anxiety ridden dog who no one will believe. Sprocket.
I don't remember. I was a little bit too young for Fraggle Rock. And I just remember it being a fever dream like most of Henson's projects.
Sorry, my neighbor's child is screaming. They're fine.
I didn't have any questions about that.
Okay.
I didn't have any questions about that. But there is no joy. There is a little bit of hope that the Book People can rebuild society, but you know, it's I get why they didn't want us to read this in Texas, because it felt very on the nose the entire time.
I think my freshman year we've talked about my freshman year English teacher mm-hmm. kind of just Mr. Lawrence doing just kind of whatever the fuck he wanted to do, which mm-hmm. looking back I love, and I'm like, you were wasted in high school English. The other students in the different English classes read 1984, and we read this. Mm-hmm. And I will say, I loved this book. I was like, right. But I mean, this was back in a time where I didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Thumbs up. And I was like, yeah, we're going to be the Book People. We're going to memorize it. We're going to teach these important lessons to everyone. And now I'm like almost 40, and I'm sitting here going, oh, yeah, no, now
there's an actual concern.
They're banning books from certain libraries. Great. Yeah. Great. Thanks for the book challenge. You can go fuck yourself. And it's like what it makes me want to do. I love there's a group that right now, like you can help support them. I'm trying to remember who they are. Like it's one of the Democratic groups, but what they're doing is they're getting all these like banned books and they just have a truck that they drive around and give banned books to places to kids and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, because 9 times out of 10, the quotes that are taken during these discussions, like where they're talking about whether or not they should ban something, are just taken out of context from a book, or it's something that they don't personally believe in. And I'm like, I hate to tell you this, Christianity isn't the only religion in the United States. It's not.
Well, And I think that goes very neatly into our first theme, which is censorship, is like how much of this is one usually very out of context, because, you know, book bans are on our minds because we both live in a place that is, Chuck's notes, not great right now, just as a state. It's one, the clipping out of context, and two, it is really all about the reinforcement of white hegemony and white supremacy and white patriarchy and supremacy and heteronormativity. Like, it's really all about control of what was once an overwhelming power is now increasingly becoming a minority in the United States and in the world. So in that sense, things like the Great Replacement Theory, where it's like, oh, all the people of color are going to replace the white people. There are a lot of factors that go into why people of color have more children than white people, or if, unless you're a millennial, where you're just skipping having kids.
We can't fucking afford it.
Yeah, caveat.
We can't build in children. Children came with my marriage. So.
Right. So, censorship as this tool to maintain a very narrow lens of what the world looks like. I was listening to, you know, Vice does those like debate things, mm-hmm. and I tend to like the Vice ones because they don't just like let people say something crazy. There's usually someone who's like, okay, that's fucking crazy. Because sometimes other like debate channels, because also I just don't believe that there are topics that are up for debate, and by debating them, you're leaning too deeply into respectability politics. But like sometimes the Vice ones, like they'll say like, okay, that's kind of crazy. But they did one on like school, like homeschool versus like letting your kids go to school, and so many of the concerns from parents, like, I don't want my kid indoctrinated. I don't want my kid believing in things that I don't believe in. And it's usually like, oh, you don't want your kids exposed to a world where homosexuality is a thing, where being gender non-binary or transgender is a thing, where there are other religions that aren't Christianity or no religion at all. You don't want your kid around a world that has science because of your beliefs. And that's where censorship, I think, is the most scary. It's where we just don't want certain things because we have a worldview we have to maintain. There are very, very few instances where I am pro-censorship, but most of the ones that we see today are just, we do not want to show that there is an option other than falling into the rat race.
Right. And we're not talking about putting, like, the Marquis de Sade in a five-year-old's hand. They won't understand that. We've talked before about, you know, certain books and stuff that we've read as older people and mm-hmm. have understood a lot better. And I feel like there should be a conversation of, hey, this has always been our thing in the family. I don't care what you read, but if you're struggling to understand it, come talk to me.
Right.
So we can go over this together, because mm-hmm. there are going to be some worldviews that are going to surprise you. Some things right. that other people say. And again, I'm not telling you to like put the Anne Rice porn novels in your kids' hands. I'm saying like they're gonna find stuff on their own because of the internet.
Oh my god!
I know 11-year-olds who know more about sex than I did at 27. So that's, I mean, it's horrifying. And yeah, you need to be watching what your kids are reading and what they're watching on TV and stuff like that. That's part mm-hmm. of just being a good parent.
Correct.
But you have to understand that they will someday be in the world. They will find things. And the more taboo that you make it, and the more you try to hide it from your kids, the more interested they get.
They'll
find it. Huh?
I have a name. That was my entire experience. But yeah, like it's so funny to listen to them talk about like, oh, well, literature is incomprehensible. It's like, yeah, it kind of is. That's the point. Like, there are different perspectives. And of course they contradict each other because not everyone has the same worldview. you know, as you mentioned, like, you know, young adult fiction, it's like, huh, why does this all kind of sound the same? Because it's the same, like, five white women writing it.
But I do want to point out that there are some incredible YA books.
We don't have, right, we do not have to clarify our position.
I'm just saying, I'm so used to doing reviews on romance novels now that are all retellings of classic fairy tales that I'm like, please stop. I know that this is what sells, and the publishers don't give a shit as long as they can sell something.
Right.
Just so we're all out there.
Yes. I think as we talk about the capitalist part of it, do you want to talk about McCarthyism?
So we've talked a little bit about McCarthyism before when we talked about the Crucible and stuff like that.
We've talked about it so much.
We've talked about it a lot, House of Un-American Activities Committee. It's the whole concept of, I don't like what you're doing, and I'm going to come out here and I'm going to label you the bad guy. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to send out all of my forces to make sure that we put focus on how bad you are and mm-hmm. keep you from living a life. We mostly saw this with the concept of communism, which was fascinating because a lot of people that ended up going through it, through the McCarthyism and being banned and being unable to work in Hollywood mm-hmm. and things like that, weren't even like full-fledged communists. They'd maybe been to a couple meetings with a friend, or, you know, they got a card because they were like, this sounded like a good idea until we saw what happened.
They were communist curious?
Yeah, communist curious. I mean, there's a lot of things that happened in Russia that a lot of people didn't know about until decades later. Mm-hmm. But the concepts of communism and socialism are absolutely fascinating. And they seem like they'd be a really good idea. There are some really great aspects of them. Unfortunately, man is by nature corrupt. And if he can find a way to, I saw that I don't necessarily agree face, but yeah. There will always be that one person who goes, I can do something with this and I can be above everyone else. And unfortunately, we saw that very, very heavily in Russia. We see that in the United States. And we're not even officially, you know, oh no, we have Medicare and we have, you know, retirement stuff. It's like, yeah, and you're trying to take that away so you can keep, we're not going into it. I'm done.
Here's the Amanda caveat. One, the issue with McCarthyism was also, again, we were trying to maintain a vibe, essentially. And that vibe excluded queer people. That vibe excluded a lot of people of color. That vibe excluded really like equal rights for women. That vibe excluded a lot of people. Communism didn't help because, especially for people of color, especially for the disenfranchised, communism and socialism are very alluring. They always have. There has always been a group of like black individuals who have looked at communism and socialism and saw that as a means to escape, as a means of samsara out of this late capital, well, now late stage capitalism. That then it was just capitalism classic. But it was still inherently disenfranchising, inherently supremacist, and inherently unfair. So, you know, it isn't so much that man is always going to be corrupt. I think that almost gives individuals too much power because it's systems that are the problem. And during that time, the system was rotten to the core. And those types of situations tend to breed and gather other people that are like-minded. Like the current crisis amongst soldiers, particularly in the army, that are white nationalists. That's something no one wants to talk about, but we should be having massive conversations about how ready the military is to arm people that want a white ethno state, send them to war, traumatize them, and then they come back and shoot up a strip mall. That's a conversation that we should be having, not, oh, we're going to boycott South by Southwest because of military profiteering. And Texas has always been a military state. Yes.
We have, I mean, there, domestic terrorism is such a huge and real threat in the United States.
Massive threat.
It's something that gets downplayed a lot. It gets, oh, well, we have, you know, we have terrorists in other countries. We have this, what's going on here. Well, you know, we got to focus on that. But the thing is,
because a lot of domestic terrorists are white. Let's be realistic.
Yes. No, 100%. I 100% agree with that. We have folks who are in the state who will go and shoot up a church. They'll go and shoot up a strip mall, like you were saying. There was somebody who my husband worked with who ended up stopping a shooting in a mall. Like, this shit happens all over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's downplayed. It's downplayed by the media. Oh, it's just one guy with mental health issues. Well, he came from somewhere, you guys. He came from somewhere.
They rose out of a pit in the desert. But McCarthyism is scary because of how much of it we see it making a resurgence. That, again, in another time of crisis, both economic, existential, that we're seeing this desire to return to a simpler time. I'm using air quotes. But that simpler time usually means a time that, like, had people in bondage.
Yeah, that's something we've talked about quite a bit on this show, mm-hmm. is that there is no such thing as a simpler time for everyone.
No, not at all. And realistically, even for the people who think they would have benefited under those circumstances, now their existences would have been objectively better, but privilege is not a paintbrush that everyone gets to use. There were still poor people. I think that brings us very, very neatly into the glorification of ignorance, which is something that I know we've both encountered a lot in our day-to-day experiences. You know, I write reviews with Tori, not as much because I get sad, but, you know, I used to tell people when I was dating, especially men, that, you know, I write reviews, you know, I do like video essay content. And the amount of times I heard, oh, well, it's just a movie. It's just a comic. Like, there's nothing really to think about. And how much each of those conversations just took a year off my life. There is a beauty to looking at the world in a very simple way. There was a sound on TikTok that was, what do you mean you just wake up happy?
Wait, people do that?
Some people. There was another one that I saw that it's like neurotypical people don't have to use like conscious energy to do basic things.
Okay, that sounds fake.
Yeah, that's fake, right? Like, what do you mean you don't sit prone in a towel for 30 to 45 minutes disassociating after a shower?
To be fair, I collect neurodivergent friends like Pokemon, so.
Turns out that happens when you're a neurodivergent, is you build a group of other people who understand you, because we can't imagine a worldview where washing the dishes isn't a Herculean task.
Laundry? What? It just lives on the chair for 4 weeks. That's just where laundry goes.
And you fold it immediately and put it away, and that doesn't take you 3 business days? But there is this almost, you know, I can see it. Because, you know, so Amber and I were talking about this when we were going to Waco, that, like, I would love to look at a world without double consciousness, without looking at everything from the perspective of someone who fundamentally is not of the same level as many of my peers because of race. I would love to see the world in a way that was less complicated. I can't. I don't have a choice. Because it's exhausting and it's tiring when everything you see is like psychically damaging.
Accidental studies of this through things like Facebook and groups where they have to go through and moderate content where people have full-on fucking breakdowns because they've never had to think about this shit before. And all of a sudden they're like, wait, this is what other people are going through. This is what these real horrible things are happening in this world. People actually believe this horrible shit. And it's like, there's a very high risk of mental breakdown and content moderation.
Yeah. Thanks for that settlement, Facebook, but also fuck you. Those content teams are a mess.
Those poor things, man.
I mean, I was one of those poor things.
I know. I just want to hug.
Poor things for a while. But there's this desire to glorify ignorance. And you see that. I see that whenever I look at like the occasional news footage talking about like particularly like Trump. I don't watch a lot of that intentionally because it makes my brain sad. But every once in a while, I'll catch like a glimpse of something. And it's just people who want to be right so much and just don't have any physical, like, balls in their court. But they so badly just want to be like, oh, we're right. This is the right thing to do. This is correct. What about all of the trials? Don't worry about that. What about all of the racism? We're actually okay with that. You know, what about all of this? Oh, that's funny. Or like Elon Musk. I'm happy to take that man down. We feel like he's a tortured genius and he's going to save the world. That is a Reddit troll with too much money. Please don't listen to him like he's God. Please.
And I mean, there is this, I understand there's a simplicity in ignorance. There's a simplicity in, I know that this is what I believe and I will never change that belief. And this is, like, I don't have to do research. I don't have to do this. My cognitive bias is just telling me that this is exactly where I need to be. Fuck it. I'm going to go have a beer and chill out. And I'm not saying everybody who is glorifying ignorance is into beer. I'm just saying that there is a simplicity in it. There is a relaxation of, well, I don't have to worry about that, or I don't have to think about that. Unfortunately, a lot of times in life, you will get smacked in the face due to that ignorance, and you will have to come to terms with the world around you. And if you are not prepared to do that, you will have even more of a breakdown. If you are not willing to take in new information, you can hurt yourself pretty severely. And remember the invectin issue where people were taken literally. Ivermectin, thank you. They were taking literal medicine for animals.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody told them that they could do that. Somebody who was not a medical professional.
Well, someone who was quote unquote a medical professional.
Quote unquote.
Like, yeah, I think that's the thing. Because like even like colloidal silver, that's my current thing to study is colloidal silver after the whole like Love Has Won cult thing, where a woman was basically mummified and wrapped in effigy in a sleeping bag and Christmas lights.
Jim Baker got Jim and Tammy Faye got busted for trying to sell colloidal silver as a cure for COVID.
Why am I not surprised by that?
But, oh, no, because he's the ultimate con man.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know why that washed over me. It's like, yeah, that sounds about right. But there is this glorification of ignorance, and I can see how, like, ignorance sometimes is really, really comforting. I don't use ignorance very often, but I do use disassociation and distraction. Because sometimes the world is too much. Sometimes there's too much going on. Sometimes I just want to read fan fiction. Sometimes I just want to write fan fiction. Sometimes I just want to watch Destination Truth.
Can we take a quick break so I can say goodbye to my college kids?
You absolutely can.
Okay. I'll be back. I'm just so you all know what just happened. Remember I said I inherited a family when I got married?
Yes.
So we have unofficially, so as far as there's no paperwork involved and we don't pay our college tuition, but we have adopted a lovely 19-year-old who is a family member from my husband's ex-wife's family. Long story short, amazing kid, love her very much. She and her partner come down all the time when we can. So they're going back up to school. And so we had to say goodbye. And I apologize for disappearing because they were supposed to leave about the right before we recorded, and they did not because they forgot to wake up. but I'm laughing because they're from the same area that Amanda grew up in, which is hilarious because whenever Amanda's like, you see what this, you see how the area influenced me, and like in other terms, it just reminds me a lot of Orange County, California, where I grew up. And I'm like, no, I get it. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah. It's so funny to me because like I've lived in San Antonio now for a good portion of my life.
Hey, you've been here for over a decade now, right?
I have, if you don't count college, because then that's like 14 years. Dies and old. But like sometimes it's just like, wow, I really am like at my core North Texan. Speaking of dies when old, I think it was like a couple of weeks ago now, I fell.
No!
I tripped over something and I fell.
Oh, you did tell me this.
Yeah, there is nothing like falling to be like, oh yes, I have been alive for 3 decades.
I'm almost to 4, man. I know that feel where you're like, wait, if I trip this time, is it going to be an emergency room visit or is it just going to be a bruise?
Yeah, I was just sore, but it was like, oh, it was rough. Speaking of being old, technology.
Tech. So I think, Amanda, our generation has seen some of the biggest major changes outside of maybe the space program. We went from...
I don't know what boomer podcast you just tried to start with me. And I don't know what fucking two bears, one cave... But neurodivergent queer women show you just started.
Listen, I remember when cell phones suddenly became a popular thing versus just the rich stockbroker dude with the giant brick in his car. Because my ex-stepfather had the giant brick in his car.
Yep.
I remember when there was no internet for home use, and then there was dial-up, and then all of a sudden we had these super fast speeds, and now you can... watch porn and political rants in under 5 minutes.
Yeah, that is true. I think there's something kind of inherently scary about technology. I do tend to think about, you know, I enjoy my fair share of like Ancient Aliens and like Monster Quest. So like when they'll talk about like, you know, prehistoric societies where it's like, oh, they didn't even have the wheel. Of course, I don't necessarily assume that means that aliens built the pyramids, but it's like, huh, like that span of time is not very long and so much has changed. But in other ways, they know how to do things. They, ancient peoples, or even as other people, indigenous people, etc., know how to do things. I am an African-American ring light. Ring light, please. Thank you. It was trying to take away my melanin.
Melanin thief.
But like, there are things that I can do that, you know, an indigenous person in the Amazon can't do. One of us is much more likely to survive in that area than the other. And my ability to do a TikTok is not the thing that's going to save me. So... technology being this thing to be kind of afraid of, I think, you know, it goes back to the other wider themes is when you use it for just distraction, when you use it to just sedate yourself. And I am not saying that from a position of someone who does not use technology as an opiate of the masses. I do. I 100% doom scroll. I am not saying this from any position of higher stature or higher anything. I'm 5'1". But it's when you aren't using that to check your bias, to check your sources. One of the things that I know I've definitely gotten into the habit of is that instead of making a judgment, I will just go and Google something. Even if I feel like I sound stupid, like I will just ask my phone, like, Google, what is this? Like, I will... do that. Like, even if I do feel like an old man sometimes, it's like, okay, what is this? And then like at least try to figure it out. And that's how Tori gets wonderful pieces of information about things like Jimmy the Raven.
I love Jimmy the Raven, though.
Jimmy the Raven's great. That was not negative.
Jimmy's the best thing. For those of you who don't know, Jimmy the Raven, and this is all from Amanda. Amanda taught me this. Was a bird actor. Mm-hmm. He's actually the giant bird on the shoulder of the uncle in It's a Wonderful Life, mm-hmm. which I always thought was funny. I'm like, why does this guy have a raven? Is he just like Odin? But that bird is my favorite part of that movie.
Yes. Jimmy's a great bird. He's an amazing actor. I mean, he's dead. I don't know why I said that. Like, he's still alive. That bird is gone.
You also teach me things about, you know, people trying to make possums a mascot of the White House. And
oh, the Billy Possum. Yes.
And
I don't know why I said that. Like, that was normal.
And then, like, the horrifying recipes you find from the 50s to send to me and ask me what's wrong with my people. And I tell you, I legitimately don't know. It's weird, but it probably tastes good.
I love horrible vintage recipes. But yeah, like, you know, there is research. I think technology is scary because of the access that it gives people. We're seeing that with the proposed TikTok ban, which I'm not going to be alarmist about at all. I will admit I need more information, but I'm not ready to be alarmist yet. They already tried to do this once and it didn't work. So before everyone starts freaking out, let's read and contact some people in power before we start, you know, running in the streets flailing. But TikTok as a tool to hear other voices, to see things that are going on, to hear perspectives of other people, it is one of the most powerful tools for that currently. And what I think is fascinating is how much of the app's algorithm is about satisfying your echo chamber, how much of it is very much tailored to your experience. Like, my favorite thing right now about TikTok is when people are like, oh, this like particular audio about like mental illness or like depression or anxiety isn't super popular. You're just mentally ill and the app knows that. Well, like, because sometimes there'll be like audios that you hear for days and it's like repeating the same thing. And it's like, oh, that's not actually like a super popular, like it's not a viral audio. You're depressed. And the app knows that. So it's going to continue to feed you that stuff. So I'm fascinated by like its ability to give me some different perspectives that I really, really cherish and value. But for the most part, all it does is validate how I already feel, which is something that I admit, especially in 2024, I feel increasingly less comfortable with on some things. On most things, you are not moving me from my opinion. But on some things, I'd like to have my mind changed. I'd like to hear other perspectives. I would love to hear how other people feel about this thing. But technology is very, very good at helping us build echo chambers. And I think that's why it's so scary.
And you know why it does that? Advertising dollars.
Well, yes. And machine learning. I think the other scary part of it is especially in the US, is that we have people making decisions about technology that don't seem to understand technology. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other conversation that we're not going to talk about because we'd be here all day.
Did you ever watch the IT Crowd?
Yes, I did.
When they were trying to explain the internet and they'd literally just made a box with a light on it and said, behold the internet. And then like mm-hmm. she took it to a meeting. That's what watching the Congress meetings looks like to me.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating how in the book, the sedating technology is usually television. And I love and hate that stereotype about television. But I don't think it's off base because yes, I could use my time and watch documentaries all day. And sometimes I do. And Tori gets more weird messages from me, like about the woman who was busy hoeing it during the Great Fire of London. So yeah, do I sometimes use my TV time to grow and learn and explore? Of course I do. Sometimes I'm just listening to guys play video games while I'm playing video games.
I will say something too that we do have to be really careful about. Again, a lot of it is commodification, mm-hmm. because the technology learns through the algorithm what to show you so you will part with your money. That's a lot of it. Shout out to my friend's podcast, Jack of All Graves. She, Corey has got some really great information along with Marco. But they talked about the Netflixication of documentaries, especially true crime documentaries, where now we're taking information that could have been a 90-minute documentary and giving you all the full details, and instead we turn it into a 5-part miniseries that doesn't need to be a 5-part miniseries, again, just for those financial dollars, and how it weakens the message and it causes problems. It was really fascinating, and they have really great information on a lot of episodes. It's all stuff that will kind of scare you a little bit. And they talk about horror movies and stuff like that too. They're great. But it is that thing that you got to kind of watch out for of, why are we changing technology? Why are we changing certain things? What is the message behind us that the creator or the creators want? What do they want from us? And that's something to watch out for when you're looking at your sources too. Who put this out? Did they do a study about how sugar is safe for you, but it was put out by Kellogg? Are these particular medicines showing really, really great results, but the trial was only 30 days long and only with a select type of people? Has this journal been peer reviewed? And if so, did somebody get busted for dishonesty previously? They're going through this with Duke right now. It's information is power. Information is important. Cite and check your sources.
Yeah. But we also have to acknowledge how difficult that can be. Like, especially, like we're reaching a place where like media literacy and just literacy in general is in question. So I do want to give credit to that. That isn't easy.
Right. It's definitely,
I definitely, and I want to acknowledge the privilege that we have to be able to do that, the privilege of time, the privilege of access, the privilege of comprehension, because sometimes I'll read a study paper and it goes completely over my head. And I do not think I'm a dumb person.
You're not.
Thank you. But I couldn't imagine other people having to try to parse that out. So there's a level of trust that unfortunately we have to give people. And I think it's that necessary trust that often gets betrayed when we have these conversations. That's the part that's messed up. And a lot of it, I think I find that I'm less, just because I've been in a lot of the meetings about things like Netflixifications like that, because I've been in marketing and advertising for like 10 years, I have less like negative views on it. Not that I don't think it's bad, but like, the people that are doing it don't necessarily have malicious intent. They just have corporate intent. Like, no one's like sitting in a room, you know, like, this is how we ruin the world. There are companies like that. But like a good 7 out of 10 are just like Mr. Krabs, money, 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 money. Like, they're not thinking this is how we take over the world. This is how we maximize profits. And it's usually dumb and short-sighted, and you have to let them be dumb and short-sighted. Speaking of, you want to talk about being dissatisfied with life?
Absolutely.
But may I start with...
Cries into Baja Blast. Sorry.
Yeah. May I start with a point of contention?
Yes, absolutely.
So we're getting Inside Out 2. I liked the first Inside Out. It was fine. It's fine. But in 2, we're getting another emotion, and they keep saying this emotion is ennui. Awesome. But, like, all the marketing is going out of their way to say that ennui is boredom, and that is not what ennui means.
Isn't it boredom to the point of death?
It's boredom to the point of death, and it also very, very closely overlaps with another word that we use sometimes, like, is malaise. Almost like malignant laziness. Of like, I'm so overwhelmed, dissatisfied, unhappy. Like, ennui, when French writers were using it, they meant it. It's sort of like how we would use sloth now, but the original sin was split up into 2, acedia and tristitia. So I understand why they have to simplify ennui down to boredom for children. But I don't But as a person who is used on Wii regularly, I have a bone to pick with you, Disney. Stop that shit. Just say boredom. You could honestly say that. Riley's what, like a teenager? You can just say she's bored.
You can also just make it French, make the character have a French accent, and adults will understand.
Right, or you could say angst. That's another big part of ennui, is like this like impotent feeling of like, oh, I want to do something, I can't. You know? So, I have words for large corporate behemoth. But yes, dissatisfaction with life.
And this is something you also see on the TikTok algorithm if you're depressed.
So much. Life is hard, says one of the hosts that's also going through it. But dissatisfaction on this level is just, it's almost hard to process in fiction now because it feels too close to home. Like, it feels like that, it feels like that meme I've sent you of Jimmy the Raven lighting a cigarette, and it's like me in the horrors. Like, it feels too close to home. So it was kind of hard to process in this book just because, like, I'm going through it. I would like some fiction that has everything being okay. Everything's fine now because there's a cat.
River's here.
She heard us talking about sadness.
She's an emotional support cat sometimes. Not officially, not the kind where you get paperwork. It's more the joke. I'm not going to take her on an airplane. One, because she would hate that.
I don't even think she'd like that.
She'd be like, no thanks. I didn't like driving in the car for 20 hours to come to Texas. So mostly just showing you to Amanda. So that
sweet baby girl. I miss that cat.
She misses you. She needs your cuddles.
She needs to sit on my car key so I can't leave again.
Exactly. She knows what she's about.
It has always been fascinating to me. Oh, also, correction to the show. So remember how I told the story of my aunt saying that she doesn't think my mother is in heaven?
Yes.
So I did talk to my aunt. I told her that I told that story all the time. And she's like, now hold on. I hope you're representing it correctly. To my aunt's credit, she meant to imply that my mother is likely in purgatory, having her soul purified for her transgressions. My aunt is incredibly Catholic. And while I did not think that that was a necessary part of the story, she was very, very concerned about the portrayal that I have cast to our audience. So please know, my aunt did not think that my mother is in hell, nor does she... graceful cat. Nor does she think that my mother was overtly a terrible person. She thinks that, like most Catholics upon death, has had to spend some time in purgatory, purifying and cleansing themselves with the hopes of returning to Christ's light when they are deemed sufficiently clean.
Gotcha.
Catholicism.
This has been Catholic Corner with Amanda.
It's so funny because I tend not to. I tend to think that I don't have religious trauma until something happens, and then it's like, oh shit, I have religious trauma.
So my question is, if you have the Catholic Corner, do I have the evangelical edge, or is it the evangelical ledge?
I'd say it's the ledge. I spent a little bit of time with evangelicals. Evangelical Edge sounds like a youth pastor podcast.
It does, and that's why I was like, wait, no, ledge. Let's wait. Ledge.
Yeah, you know there are some youth pastor named like Ryan,
who's Jason, sitting in Justin,
an inn of some kind. You know, Brixton. Who is sitting in a chair backwards saying, you know, sometimes the real cap or no cap is how much Jesus loves you. I'm going to jump off a bridge, excuse me.
Have I told you the boards versus broad story?
The who?
So, our youth pastor made a sign for a car. We were going on a youth group ski trip, which, first and foremost, I should not have been on a ski trip. I almost died skiing once. Like, I just went because my sister was going and my mom was like, you should go. And I was like, I don't like youth group. But I went anyway because one of my friends was going, and I was like, fine. We go to get into the vans, and one is supposed to say skis and boards, but my youth pastor, in his not refusing to proofread, had printed one that said skis and broads. And my mom walks up to him and she goes, Jim, I don't think that sign says what you want it to say. And he's like, what is, oh, keep in mind, this is the same youth group that I decided I did not want to go to Lake Havasu with them because I was older and I was like, I don't really like the vibe of this place. Mm-hmm. My sister ate a piece of skin off of the assistant youth pastor's toe for $20. These youth pastors used to drive the van in what they called a UFO formation, where they would go across three lanes of traffic with 15 children in the car. Because Jesus was watching after us, man. They were just having fun. I love your face right now. It's like, I believe this, but also,
yeah, it's like, there's no part of me. There is no part of me that questions the validity of that statement. It's just the, like,
why were these people in charge of children?
Why were these people? Question mark. Yeah, like, what do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? That sounds insane.
It was insane. It was insane. And the funny thing is, looking back and explaining things to people, like, oh yeah, because you now hear, again, on TikTok, you now hear a lot of people who came out of the evangelical world, and they're like, did our parents know what they were saying to us?
At least in my case, my parents did, and they agreed with it, which was the problem. But being dissatisfied with life, I think that's something that's so natural and so normal, especially in late stage capitalism, because it is really easy to just be overwhelmed with the horrors. And you do almost have to pick and choose your battles. I mean, I know I've had to. I've absolutely had to dip out of news stories because I can't fucking process it. Like, I've had to stop reading about Boeing disasters.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's stressing me.
I could tell you a lot of stuff that I just heard about, like what happened to one of the whistleblowers, but we won't go into that because it'll just stress us both out and our listeners.
Oh, I know about the whistleblower. And the recent, yeah. So I've absolutely had to, like, dip out of things because it's like, I have too much going on in my own fucking corner. I don't need this.
Oh, and I used to watch the nightly news, and I used to watch news in the morning. Mm-hmm. I was a news junkie. I was one of those kids who wanted to be Barbara Walters. And I literally, as an adult now, have had to be like, I'm going to read up on this when I don't feel like reading about this news story is going to make me stab a knife through my eye. Like,
right.
And right. Here's the thing. There are always going to be aspects of your life that you're dissatisfied with. That's part of the human condition. You... Mm-hmm. grow and you change and you find ways to embrace new aspects of life so that you enjoy your life. You find little things. I think it was Dennis Leary who was like, you eat a cookie, you have an orgasm. It's not always going to be great. You do have to have, you have these little moments of that just keep you going. But when you are so dissatisfied with life that you can't get out of bed, that's a problem. We see a lot of this, especially because we've now are going through the COVID years. You know, we were part of lockdown. We watched friends and family members die and people be extremely ignorant and put other people at risk because they didn't want to believe big pharma and our government and stuff. They didn't want to believe medical professionals who actually knew what they were talking about. And a lot of them who didn't. It is that insecurity and that, wait, why aren't people taking certain things seriously? We see this with Guy when he's like, there is literally a war coming. We're hearing these planes. We're seeing bombers be deployed. And y'all are just talking about this as a funny thing that's happening on a Saturday. Like, there is something serious coming. But to that point as well, it is so overwhelming sometimes being alive. One of the things that kind of ties back into technology, we think, oh, you know, the world has gotten so much worse and, you know, we're so much crueler to each other. We're not. We're just able to see it in real time now. You don't have to wait on one guy traveling from town to town with news stories to tell you over the fire. You don't have a loved one sending you a letter. You have them sending you a text message or an email in 5 seconds. There is pressure and change, and you're seeing things move faster than we ever have before because of tech. And yeah, that does amplify your emotions. It does amplify the concept of being dissatisfied with your life, especially if you're seeing people put on this fake show about this is my perfect family with my perfect kids who are perfect in every way. And you know that somebody in that family is screaming inside. But we want to present this face to the world of look how great my life is, even with that dissatisfaction. And it does a disservice to everyone.
It does. But I also see, like, you know, I mean, I'm fully fake it till you make it, you know, because sometimes you have to keep up that mask because the true you just isn't it. Like, just, it's like, and there's nothing wrong with, like, you know, validating your emotions. I'm the first person to say validate your emotions. But sometimes those emotions just overwhelm you. And you have to put on, you know, the little happy dance, like everything is okay. But yeah, it was interesting to read about this because it's like, I am currently dissatisfied with life. I did not need this representation in fiction. Would you like to talk about, yes.
We also have this thing where we kind of as a society have forgotten about nuance. We have forgotten absolutely. That every person is different. Every person's interactions with the world are different. And there are different levels to different things. Keep in mind, I can pontificate all I want all day long, but my story and my life isn't the same as yours. There are things that work for me that don't work for you. There are things that are true in my life that don't work for other people. Mm-hmm. And that's part of being alive and part of being human. So not everything I or Amanda say is going to be the gospel truth to you.
Absolutely. I mean, please don't take anything I say as being the gospel truth of anything. Immediately uncomfortable with that level of responsibility.
Yeah, I'm sorry. My kid would disagree, but you don't want me as a parent.
Yeah, like immediately uncomfortable with that level of responsibility. Please don't take anything I say as gospel fucking truth. The Gospel of Amanda would be the shortest, most manic book of the Bible.
Mine would just end with Jesus wept.
Oh my God. All right, now would you like to talk about the book and Ray Bradbury?
Absolutely. So Ray Douglas Bradbury was born on August 22nd, 1920 in Waukegan, Illinois, to Esther and Leonard Spalding Bradbury. Leonard was a Swedish immigrant. Ray's middle name came from Douglas Fairbanks, which I love. I love the fact that his family was like, yes, we will give our child the middle name of an actor. Ray Bradbury was a weirdo, and he's one of my favorite writing weirdos. He was born a month late. And he used to claim that this allowed him to remember his own birth because he had more time to develop, which I'm like,
that's physically impossible.
But are you okay? When he was little, he had a lot of family around in Waukegan. So his aunt would read him short stories. And you'll see his hometown show up in a lot of his fiction as Greentown, Illinois. So that's in like Dandelion Wine and a few others. So when his dad would be in between jobs in Waukegan, they would go to Tucson, Arizona, so his dad could get work. And they went back and forth for a long time. But when Ray Bradbury was about 14, they ended up in L.A. L.A., and I realize I say it like that because I grew up in the area, and it cracks me up every time I think of Letterkenny when they're making fun of people. Let's get tacos and go hiking in L.A. And I'm like, yeah. Okay. Do you know how bad my accent gets when I'm actually around Californians? It's horrific, you guys. Anyway, Bradbury went to Los Angeles High School, and he was in the drama club. Not surprising. he loved to roller skate through Hollywood and Beverly Hills and stuff, and he would run into celebrities. These included Ray Harryhausen, who would end up becoming a really good friend, and George Burns. He actually sold a joke to George Burns when he was 14, and it earned him one of his first payouts. He started writing really young, and this is the anecdote about how he told people he started writing. So this is Ray Bradbury's own words. This is a story that gets brought up over and over and over again when you're reading his history. Quote, "I suppose the most important memory is of Mr. Electrico. On Labor Day weekend in 1932, when I was 12 years old, he came to my hometown with the Dill Brothers. He was a performer sitting in an electric chair, and a stagehand pulled a switch, and he was charged with 50,000 volts of pure electricity. Lightning flashed in his eyes, and his hair stood on end. I sat below in the front row, and he reached down with a flaming sword full of electricity and tapped me on both shoulders and then the tip of my nose and cried, 'Live forever!' And I thought, God, that's wonderful. How do you do that? So when I left the carnival that day, I stood by the carousel and I watched the horses running around and around to the music of beautiful Ohio, and I cried. Tears streamed down my cheeks because I knew something important had happened to me that day because of Mr. Electrico. I felt changed, and so I went home, and within days I started to write, and I never stopped." And I mean, this carnivals and stuff show up in a lot of his writing. He also had a lot of inspiration. So Bradbury, he absolutely loved to read. He started writing stories at 12, as we discussed, sometimes writing them on butcher paper in the kitchen. He was a big fan of H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, and Edgar Allan Poe, obviously.
Obviously.
He tried to imitate Poe's writing for a long time when he was younger, but he did change that. He also found Edgar Rice Burroughs' John Carter of Mars series a huge deal. And so he ended up writing his own fan fiction sequel. So when I tell you that writers will write fan fiction, I'm not kidding.
Sometimes they'll write fan fiction of their own works.
When he was a teenager, he spent a lot of time with sci-fi writer Bob Olson, who was kind of his mentor. In 1936, when he was at a used bookstore, he found a flyer for a meeting of the Los Angeles Science Fiction Club, which is still in existence today. And he joined their Thursday night meetings when he was 16 at Clifton's Cafeteria in downtown LA. Clifton's is delicious. I miss it so much. I don't know if they're even still in business. I hope they are. He met Robert A. Heinlein right after he... Bradbury met Robert Heinlein after he finished high school, like right after. And he said that Heinlein's writing dared him to focus more on the human aspects rather than the mechanical aspects of sci-fi. And I don't know if you've ever read Stranger in a Strange Land, but yes. Bradbury was, wait, did we cover that on this podcast?
Or
did
I just
read it for fun? I think
you read it for fun.
So Bradbury was actually rejected from military service for World War II because he had horrific eyesight. If you've ever seen a picture of him, he's got like the giant Coke bottle glasses.
Just so thick.
He started writing sci-fi and publishing in fanzines. In 1939, he was given money to go to New York City for the first World Science Fiction Convention. And the donor, a man with the last name Ackerman, also funded his fanzine called Futuria Fantasia. He wrote almost all of the four issues that came out, which, according to rumor, only printed about 100 copies each. He also contributed to Rob Wagner's film magazine Script over time. And then in 1939, he also joined the Wilshire Players Guild run by Lorraine Day. And for 2 years, he wrote and acted in plays. But he said that the plays he wrote were so bad that he gave up writing them for 2 decades.
Yeah, that happens.
He ended up earning $15 for a short story, Pendulum, which was written by him and Henry Haas. It was published in Super Science Stories. And then he sold his first short story that he wrote alone called The Lake and at the age of 22 for $13.75. I saw a clip of him talking, and he used to do talks for writers and stuff like that. It's kind of an encouragement thing, like a giving back thing. And he would be like, the first year, I made no money. The second year, I made no money. The third year, I made no money. The fourth year, I made $13. Like, he would go through and tell you, and then he would tell you like how he finally started making money. And I will tell you, as a writer, that is the most comforting thing to hear of like, yeah, you're not going to make any money in the beginning. Sorry. That's just what's going to happen. You're going to make $20 at one point in time. You're going to be like, yes, This story makes me really happy because it talks about another writer that we've covered on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Bradbury was rejected with a story that he wrote called Homecoming that he sent to Weird Tales. I've also been rejected from Weird Tales. But then he ended up submitting it to Mademoiselle. And guess who rescued it from the slush pile? Truman fucking Capote. He found it, it led to publication, and then that led to Bradbury getting a place at the O. Henry Awards in 1947 for science fiction.
I'm like, Truman Capote just responsible for everything that happened?
A lot of the drama, yeah.
it's not six degrees of Kevin Bacon, it's 6 degrees of Truman Capote.
I know, it feels like it in a lot of the stuff that we read now. So Bradbury published a short story called The Fireman. This is going to go into our book here, mm-hmm. in Galaxy Science Fiction. And then a publisher asked him to extend it by 25,000 words so they could turn it into a novel. That novel was Fahrenheit 451. And the title, the anecdote states that he came from talking to a fire chief in Los Angeles who told him paper burns at 451 degrees Fahrenheit. And what's really funny is I've heard British people refer to it as Fahrenheit 451. I've heard multiple people refer to that. I have always heard it as Fahrenheit 451.
I've always heard it's 451.
So say what you like, whatever makes you happy. He lived at home until he was 27 years old, and that's the year he married the fabulous Marguerite Maggie McClure. McClure? Mm-hmm. That name sounds familiar. This was the first and only woman he ever dated. They were together until she passed away in November 2003. Like, together for a very long time. Mm-hmm. They had four daughters who were Susan, Ramona, Bettina, and Alexandra. And Ray Harryhausen was actually the best man at Ray Bradbury's wedding.
Oh.
So you got like Jason and the Argonauts. But anyway, Bradbury never got his driver's license. He used his public transportation and his bike. And I can confirm this as a fact because when I worked at Barnes & Noble, I had a manager who was absolutely amazing. And we would just talk. And she's like, oh, yeah, I used to work at up closer to L.A. So as a courtesy, I would go pick up Ray and I would drive him to meetings and things so he could do talks and signings and, you know, go to conventions and stuff. And she goes, that man could never keep food off his tie. She goes, we would go eat and he would just immediately right on the tie. And I was just like, you've met Ray Bradbury? She's like, yeah, he's a doll. He's such a sweetheart. And I'm like, you know Ray Bradbury.
I love when that happens, when it's just like, oh, talks about very, very famous person. It's like, you know this person?
Yeah, to her, he's just Ray. Like, oh yeah, I just go pick him up. He was raised Baptist, but his family wasn't super into going to church. And he ended up, like a lot of people in this time period, combining Eastern and Western beliefs and faiths into his life. And he called himself a delicatessen religionist.
Fair.
So he was really good friends with Charles Adams, AKA of Adams Family fame. Mm-hmm. They were planning to do a huge collaboration that was the family's complete history, but the project just never came together, which is mm-hmm. heartbreaking because can you imagine how great that would have been? He was also good friends with the Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry. Gene once asked Bradbury to write for Star Trek, but he turned it down because he said he didn't like to write for pre-established worlds. Like he said, it made him feel weird.
Fair.
And I'm like, does that have to do with your John Carter of Mars experiments as a child?
Probably.
He had a stroke in 1999 that left him partially dependent on a wheelchair. And he was still writing pieces about inspiration and being a writer up until a week before his death. So, I mean, the man, when he said he started writing at 12 and never stopped, he wasn't kidding.
Right.
He passed away June 5th, 2012, at the age of 91 after a long illness. And his personal writings and library information stuff were donated to his childhood library in Waukegan, Illinois. And he is buried in Westwood Village Memorial Park in L.A. And it has listed, you know, a writer of Fahrenheit 451. Things that piss me off, the home that he lived and wrote in, this is the most L.A. story ever. It was purchased by a man named Tom Maine, who ended up bulldozing it. This happens a lot in Los Angeles. Property is expensive. Land is expensive. People do what they want. There's a joke from Eddie Izzard, we'll just smash it to the floor and put a car park here. That is accurate.
It is.
one of his stories, I Sing the Body Electric from the book of the same name, was adapted as the 100th episode of The Twilight Zone. And it was aired in 1962. Fun story. The lyrics for the song Rocket Man by Elton John and Bernie Taupin were based on Bradbury's writings, because Bradbury wrote a story where being an astronaut was just a basic job. And Taupin was so fascinated by that. He's like, Elton, I wrote these lyrics. What do you think? And Elton's like, yeah. And then we end up with our boy from Star Trek singing, and I'm going to be high as a kite by then. William Shatner covering it at the Sci-Fi Awards is one of my favorite videos.
Also, Rocket Man, one of my like top disassociation songs.
Yes.
One of my top, like, I'm lying in bed, it is dark, and just don't worry about it. He won a ridiculous amount of awards.
Yeah, there are so many awards and so many adaptations. I will obviously post our resources if you're interested. I mean, the man won a Stoker Award. I think he won a Hugo Award. I mean, he won, if you could win an award, he won it when it comes to sci-fi. Which is really interesting because he didn't necessarily consider a lot of his writing sci-fi. He found it more to be fantasy, which I love. I love his writing style because it's very human. Just like we're talking about with the Heinlein stuff, like he focused more on the human aspects of things. There is one short story that haunts my dreams, and I need to remember what it's called. But it was about a classroom of kids, and it only rain, or there's only sunshine one day a year on this planet. And they lock one of the kids in the closet while the sunshine is out, and he misses it. And it's like a once in a lifetime thing. And it like, it broke my heart so bad. I was like, kids are awful. I hate children. Like,
so much. Oh my God.
I need to remember what it's called. And we're probably going to get like Jason or somebody yelling at us going, it's called this. But like, there's the Halloween tree got turned into a cartoon, and I think in the '80s, and that is one of my husband's absolute favorite things to watch at Halloween. I kept trying to find, I don't intentionally look for drama with our authors, but a lot of times it's really easy to find because writers were emotional. We occasionally like to play with drama. I had a really hard time finding really anything other than him having political beliefs that I didn't necessarily believe in, and calling Clinton an asshole, which fair. And like hating Lyndon Johnson so much that he decided to officially leave the Democratic Party. Again, fair. He liked George W. Bush. That's like the most dirt I could find. I'm like, okay. And somebody's probably going to come forward and be like, these are all the bad things he did. Feel free. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, please. Well, no, actually. All right. We have some resources, do we not?
We have a lot. As always, I end up going through Spark Notes just to help me get my thoughts in line while we do our description. Wikipedia, because Wikipedia gives me first sources that I can go through and confirm. There, and then I put a bunch of, I have to fix one of those things in there. I got a lot of just kind of secondhand information from YouTube. Just there's one documentary of him from the 60s that is the most 60s documentary I've ever seen. I actually sent it to Amanda because I was cracking up.
Yes, you did.
A lot of losses and stuff. And this one guy looks like Rod Sterling. It looks like he's going to do a Twilight Zone episode. And he's like, Ray Bradbury, a writer from California. And you're like, it's just the way that they talked in those old documentaries is so funny to me. It's like, it reminds me of how we always know what a 1920s radio announcer sounds like, even though that's not how everyone talked. Like, it's just, anyway. Did you have to read this in school?
So I did not. Again, I'm from Texas. They would not give away their secrets to a bunch of teenagers. And I think about that a lot. Like, there are a lot of books that I didn't read when I was in school. And it's like, oh, yeah, because why would they want to put this into our brains? Because then we'd have questions.
But then they still had you read Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Okay. That was at a weird Episcopalian school.
That is the worst book I've ever read, dude. And I've read part of 50 Shades of Grey.
I love that, like, out of all the books that Tori has been forced to read because of me, the one that to this day that she's mad about is Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Yes.
And I'm not saying that to discredit your feelings, because I also hate that book. My aunt loves it.
So I found out that one of my best friends, her husband's favorite book is Les Mis. And so she was like reading a bunch of stuff that he was recommending. And she's like, this book is horrible. This book is horrible. And then we ended up having a group chat where everyone was like, oh yeah, remember all the pages about the Paris sewers? And it was like this, all of us suffering together.
Yep.
And I was like, yes, yes, we've been through the same horrific event.
We have all had this very, very interesting experience with the Paris sewers. But Tori, you had to read this.
We did have to read this. Read this freshman year because, like I said, Mr. Lawrence was off book a lot, which was great. Mm-hmm. We read this instead of 1984, and I remember it was one of the books that I enjoyed. I was like, this is really interesting.
I love that for you. Tori specifically said in our chat that she wants to dunk on the settlers. So what are we reading next month?
We are going to be reading Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder. And I should preface, this was one of my favorite books as a child. This was the first book that I read under the covers with a flashlight because I wanted to finish it. I have very different feelings as an adult, very different feelings after reading things like Killers of the Flower Moon, very different feelings after reading a lot more history about Manifest Destiny and what mm-hmm. settlers did to the Native peoples. It's going to be a wild ride.
And as I said in our chat, I was over here just like that gif from Pocahontas, these white men are dangerous the entire time.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness gracious. But I'm excited to read it.
Have you ever read it before? Oh, no, you haven't.
I feel like I have, or at least it's one of those books that I absorbed via pop culture. Like, I'm 70% sure that I've read it as a kid. But if not, I mean, I definitely saw the TV show. Because I had a grandpa who was born in the 1940s.
I remember my grandpa was very into MASH and he was very into Gunsmoke.
My dad was very into MASH.
My husband is very into MASH. Like, I joke, I'm like, Grandpa Bob prepared me for this.
Yeah, my dad was very into MASH. We also watched a lot of ER together.
We watched a lot of Law and Order.
And people wonder why we're weird.
Yeah.
There's it's not shocking.
I was a kid and we were watching Law and Order and somebody got shot in the throat and I was like, and it was like a mob hit and I was just like, what is this? And I'm like way too young to be watching it.
Right. But yeah, I am interested to go back through this. It will be, I'm sure, a fascinating time. We are mostly over social media, including Facebook, where Tori just recently shared a meme that I sent her.
Yes, about the Ides of March.
That was a good meme.
This is a good meme. I will say, SparkNotes is on their game with memes and TikToks and stuff. Like, if you have any sort of semblance of knowledge about literature, their stuff is so freaking funny.
It is.
And if you don't, it'll educate you.
Very much so. We're still on Instagram, and we still have our website, unfortunaterequiredreading.com. You know what? I've given up on Twitter. So if you want us to move to Threads, let us know.
I just created a personal Threads account. I've been on there once.
I will say, I think if it was removing Twitter to go to Threads, that's easier to manage. But, like, if it was having to manage Threads and Twitter and, it'd probably be a little bit too hard for me. Because I have that with my other show where I have to do Blue Sky and Twitter. That's too much. That's too much for me.
We are a once-a-month podcast. We are exhausted, friends.
Yeah, we have a lot going on and we are very tired. So, Tori, would you like to do the little wrap-up part? If you'd like to suggest us a book?
Sure. If you'd like to suggest a book for the podcast, or if you have a funny story about your classes and school and literature, you can email us at unfortunatelyrequiredreading@gmail.com.
Correct.
Also, thank you so much to our patrons. Well, it's not really our patrons, but our supporters. We don't have a Patreon. Our supporters, particularly Baron Von Cheeseplate, who keep the literal and metaphorical lights on for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We love you, obviously. You know that. Yes. Even though we like to tease and torment you, that's part of the job, man. That's part of the job.
I like to tease and torment him because he has been in my life, I think at this stage, longer than my dad.
Oh my God. Oh, by the way, how was your dead dad cake?
It was amazing. Why don't we do this officially?
I am already planning because my dad, before he passed away from cancer, which mm-hmm. sucked, he started getting a voracious appetite, which
yeah.
probably should have been my first sign that something was going on.
Probably.
He would make chocolate cake in a Bundt pan, mm-hmm. and then he would eat vanilla ice cream with it. And that was his favorite freaking thing.
Perfect. So I'm going to
do a chocolate cake and have vanilla ice cream with it in honor of my dad in May, because he passed away May 21st.
That sounds lovely. Yeah, for those of you who, this is your first episode, which, oh, how did you find us?
Are you okay? Do you need help? Are you in jail? Do you need us to get you out? I mean, I don't have any money, but.
Yeah, neither of us have money, but we certainly can try. Tori and I both have dead dads, and I think it was you shared the TikTok with me that a young lady who had also lost her father made herself a happy dead dad day cake. And my father's death anniversary was in February, and it was phenomenal. We need to do this more often because it's a horrible day.
It is so
rough.
We were laughing because some people are like, oh, that's so disrespectful and stuff. It's like, that's how we know you're not in the dead dad club, because
right.
you've been through some of the worst parts of your whole fucking life already.
Yep.
And you learn ways to celebrate their memory and be a little irreverent and joke around, because death comes for us all. I know how fun that is to hear. But yeah, why not celebrate them a little bit? Why not give yourself cake? You deserve cake.
And I also think it's funny because it's like, you don't know my dad. He would have loved this shit.
My dad would be laughing his ass off. Right, he would thought this was the funniest shit he's ever heard in his life.
Like, I think that's the other big part about it. Is like, oh, that's so morbid and disrespectful. My dad would want nothing more. If he was able to make accommodations from the afterlife, he'd send the cake himself. He'd love that shit.
He'd be into it.
My dad would be so into it. Oh my gosh, I'm having, so we had a red velvet cake shop back home called Red Oven, and they specialized in like just red velvet cake.
That's awesome.
And they made so many of my fucking birthday cakes. I don't want to tell you how many of my birthday cakes came from Red Oven Bakery back home. They are very, very closed.
They're closed? Okay.
Yes, they do not exist.
I was just going to look them up to see if I could find them.
No, if they were still open, I would not live in San Antonio anymore. They had like prepared cheese balls and pimento cheese, which is a staple in Southern households, where you're just eating a grilled cheese made with pimento cheese instead of sliced cheese.
It happens.
I love a pimento grilled cheese sandwich. I was on sudden complaint. But yeah, it's like my dad would love a dead dad cake. So you know what? Go find a little thing to give yourself a little treat. There are many horrors and atrocities outside. Here's one of my little treats. When I went to the Dr. Pepper Museum, I got one of the very, very dumb Dr. Pepper cups.
Oh, you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of like when you used to go to Pizza Hut and they had them on the table.
Yeah, so it looks like the Pizza Hut tumbler, but it's Dr. Pepper, and I got it from the Dr. Pepper Museum.
Dude, that's badass.
I'm so excited.
ASMR.
Yeah, ASMR. It sounds like my childhood. So you know what? Go out and get yourself a little treat today. The horrors are abundant, but what I'm always impressed about is the immense just capacity for hope that human beings have. Also, this is an election year. I know it's early. Start looking at some of those elected officials and consider that you might not like an individual aspect of an individual leader, but this isn't about you. It's about everyone. I'm just going to say that.
Has Ted Cruz done anything good for Texas?
Has Ted Cruz done anything good?
Why is Ted Cruz?
What is Ted Cruz?
That's the most important question.
We're going to stop recording before we turn into a conspiracy podcast.
My husband is currently wearing a shirt that says, I out Pizza the Hut, and now the CIA is looking for me everywhere. Because that's the kind of t-shirt I buy my husband for Christmas.
I respect that. We'll see you guys in the next one. Bye. Bye.